And our guest tonight, Carmen Bolter, as we talk about the Pyramid Code on Coast to Coast AM. So, Carmen, we were saying that if they heard something on this program from you and it was something of incredible value, you think they'd shut it down, they'd suppress it?
Well, I don't want to be filled with my own self-importance, but the fact is that after the Pyramid Code came out, they essentially made it impossible to go to Abu Ghraib, which is where the quartz crystal altar is and all those interesting satellite-like dishes that are made out of quartz. They closed the any possible way of getting up to Abu Roush. And Abu Ghraib, you know what that sounds like. That sounds like a jail. So,
you know,
they named it that. And so obviously they know something about what's going on, but they expected, you know, people not to want to go. And so I have noticed things that are in the Pyramid Code that suddenly there's a distraction. But if you want to take a group into Abu Ghraib right now, it'll cost you $1,100.
Each?
No.
Or just the tour?
For the group. But that's quite pricey.
That's more pricey than
a $10 ticket.
Yeah, that's still pricey.
And so they're really trying to make it prohibitive. And last time we went there, it took us 2 hours to get tickets. It's down the road. It's like, you know, you can ride a camel there. You know, it's 5 miles down the road.
I want to get into these segments and images you sent us.
Okay.
And then we'll get back into some theories about the pyramids. Three different galleries. Paint pictures for those, Carmen, who might not have computers. But if you want to see these images, they're at coasttocoastam.com under our highlight carousel reel. The first is the Green Apparition Gallery. What is that?
All right. So I saved these for you, George.
Thank you.
Because I've had these pictures for a while, and I didn't want to go public with them until I could show them to you.
Perfect.
Okay, so let's move along here. What you see is something. Okay, this is during the Sound and Light show. I took them with an 18-megapixel digital SLR camera, and I saw something out of the corner of my eye, and I thought, well, I'm not sure. You know, you kind of twist your eyes up and blink a little bit, and then I got the camera out, and I wondered if the camera would be able to capture it. And so as you move along the pictures, you see something that actually looks like it's flying. And moving closer to the pyramids, you can see that the pyramids are changing colors because it's the Sound and Light show. But the apparition is moving. Can you see that?
I sure do.
Okay.
Looks like a hologram.
It looks like a hologram. Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I never thought of that. And then when you move along, then suddenly there's two. But they definitely look like they're flying and they're changing angles.
Mm-hmm. Sure does.
Yeah. And then continue going across the sky, and then it's approaching the center of the second pyramid.
And they're huge.
And it's huge. And so it's impossible that this is the lights from the Sound and Light show. I've seen the Sound and Light show just because it's invasive in the village. When you're there, it comes to you. And I've seen it probably 2,000 times. So this is not part of what they're doing. Now, on the very last picture, where the green apparition is at the top of the pyramid, exactly positioned, you've got to wonder. You can see that there's a projection over the Sphinx's face. And that's what they've been doing. They've been using projection screens to do that. But you can't make it fly across the sky. There's absolutely no way that hasn't. And you couldn't see it naturally with the naked eye, though you could see the thing around the Sphinx's face. So I don't even want to speculate, other than the fact that over time, I saw apparitions in the Great Pyramid when I was there in 1977 and took photographs. And I went and asked what was wrong with my camera. They said nothing. Well, over time, cameras are picking up more and more orbs, but more complex orbs. But sometimes there's so many, it's like you're in a blizzard. But this last two trips, people were picking up like plasma energies, colored energies that were bands. And so it's like there's more activity and more interfacing between, I don't know, the other side, more refined realms. I'm not sure. But when I listen to William Henry talk, and he's showing pictures and talking about plasma beings who are going toward the galactic center and that sort of thing, and he's showing images of stained glass windows from churches, I'm looking at these pictures thinking, is this something of today that he's talking about?
What, and could you see these with your naked eye?
Out of the corner of my eye. Not well enough.
Not like we're seeing on the pictures.
But more in the blue one. Are we ready to go to the
Holy Grail?
The Holy Grail.
This is weird.
So now, it looks like it's spinning. And honest to God, it really does look like a wine goblet.
It does.
Okay. Now, And as you can see, the pyramids aren't moving, and it is changing. If it was spinning and it was made out of light, it would do this. But it's got different colors, and as you move along, you can see that it's in front of the pyramid when it's green. So it's actually projecting onto it. That's, I don't know.
And this is huge. This is bigger than the other ones.
And it's bigger than, yeah, well, one of them was the night before. The green apparitions were the night before this. So I was staying at the Sphinx guest house, and they've got big open windows. The sound and light show was on, so I was kneeling on the couch with my elbows out the window and got my camera, and that's what I saw. Now, they were also measured for lens flares because there's certain angles. But the thing is, if you don't move the camera, then how does the lens flare move? And the thing is, it has to be at certain angles to reflect off the lights below. And that just didn't add up. So, yeah. And so there you have it, moving across and getting seemingly more intense. But if you look at the third to last one, that goblet is almost as big as the second pyramid.
I know. It's huge.
What do you think it is?
And again, it could be a hologram. I don't know what it is.
Hologram.
If it's a craft... it's a darn unusual one, but I wouldn't put it past Zahi at that time to shoot holographic images up there with some kind of technology. You know, they're still talking about Project Bluebeam, this false flag, that we're going to see UFOs scattered throughout this planet, and all of us will run to our leaders and say, please help us, don't let them get us.
Yeah, I know, and we have to be strong.
That's right. So what if they have this technology, and this is part of it? They were using it.
Well, that's not something I thought of, to tell you the truth. More along the lines of it being an energy being showing itself, and that as, like, angels can make themselves a little bit denser,
sure,
as we make our energy a little more refined, and for a split second we can make a connection and actually see something, and I think that there is more and more of that going on. Well, I would like to see what kind of projection machine they use to make this thing spin and move.
Absolutely.
And be so big.
I know, but it's worth looking into.
Well, it is. And you know what's also wonderful is that, you know, it maintains a sense of mystery. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, I know exactly what that is.
Exactly.
Because I don't, but that doesn't mean that it's not interesting or that it didn't happen.
No, exactly. The next series of images from Dendera, tell us about that.
Okay, now, if you move along, there's one that shows you exactly how dark that ceiling used to be. The ceiling used to be like chocolate, like black coffee. Well, actually, it's in the first one. So you can see how detailed. Now, this ceiling is 40 feet up, and again, 18-megapixel camera allowed me to photograph the entire ceiling and then blow up little pieces to actually look at it, because even standing on the ground looking up, it's just too far away.
How'd it get so dark before, that ceiling? Just dirt?
Mold. They're not allowed adding paint, but they're allowed to remove mold.
Ah.
And when the Christians came and did their damage, they lit fires inside a lot of these temples. So it's a combination of mold and soot.
And soot, yeah.
Yeah. And so what you see, so you could just bear with me for a minute here. The dark square on the bottom left part here, you can imagine why we couldn't decipher the ceiling if that's what the whole thing looked like, correct?
That's right. Oh, you couldn't.
Okay. So it's taken them almost 2 years to clean it, a year per side. And they never even attempted to do that before. When people talk about the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, the Dendera Zodiac, they're referring to a circular structure that's upstairs in the temple that when Napoleon came, he cut it out, made a replica, put the fake one there, and took the other one to the Louvre. But this is brand new, and very few people have seen it because we've had the revolution in between here where tourism has been, you know, minimized because of it. So if we move along the pictures, we see all kinds of very interesting stars, as I say, therianthropes, half animal, half human.
Mm-hmm.
Images of somebody holding the Eye of Horus, snakes up on an altar, if you will, a lion being with a snake on an altar, a woman holding her breast, kneeling on an altar. And so as you move along, you see that there's an entire cast of characters, and then there's a story. It's very beautiful. I mean, and I just stare at these and keep looking and looking for the symbols and seeing what I can. So now I'm on the third one, and what you see is a four-winged being with two snake heads, one looking one way, one looking the other, with two different kinds of feathers on its head. Well, this is actually a marker for the precession of the equinoxes. If you divide it into cross quarter points, which is what solstices and equinoxes do, is you get 6,500 years in each of the quarters. And so in the past, when we looked at the Golden Age, it looked like it was bigger than, and I think they're even, but there's a different perception of time and space in the different quadrants of the precession of the equinoxes. So under this being's feet is Isis upside down holding up a winged disc. And so you see that repeated over and over again. You see a child who's naked and has got a tuft of hair. That's how you can see it's a child.
Which image are we on?
Third one from the left.
Right, that's the one I got up. Okay.
You see a solar boat, which William Henry would say is the shape of a wormhole. The Eye of Horus contains all of the sacred geometry for pretty much everything in the different proportions of it. And so this is the creation mythology for how we got here and how we leave.
Why don't we ever see pictures of the Sphinx on any of these things?
Well, there are some Sphinx-like ones right in that picture where you see it on
I meant the pyramids.
Pyramids, because I think it's a completely different age.
Yeah, that's what I was going to... Yeah, there is a picture
they don't connect.
Of the Sphinx.
So you don't see these figures around the pyramids, and you don't see pyramids around the figures. So I think that they're completely different epochs, and they feel different, and they're not even in the same location. You don't find temples where you find the pyramids, and you don't find pyramids where you find the temples. And not too many people notice that or say much about that, because it's all in Egypt, but you have to get on a flight to go down to where the temples are, and you're closer to the Nile. Now, that's not to say that the Nile didn't go past the pyramids before.
Have you seen the tablet or the etching in Abydos?
Oh, yeah.
It's a helicopter. It's a submarine.
Yeah.
It's a boat.
Yeah. And the other thing is it was hidden, and that the stone fell off the lintel recently. And then all of the pharaohs in the 18th dynasty, Hatshepsut, Tut, and Akhenaten, were erased off the king's list because they were remembering the distant past and they were making sense of it. And so there was this real patriarchal political agenda with the Amun priesthood, which is the period of darkness, and it's replicating what we're going through now. And so there's definite lessons. I mean, this stuff about Egypt is not that far-fetched, really, by comparison, because we are returning to these principles. We're returning to... And what's happening is procreation is threatened with all of the chemicals that we've got going
sure.
on, right?
What's the significance of the similarities between these pyramids worldwide, including China, Bosnia, Central America, everywhere?
Well, they are conductors of a certain kind of energy, and they magnify it the way they're built. Some pyramids, the more modern ones, actually don't conduct energy the way others do, and there's been testing done on that, like charging seeds and John Burke's work. But most of the pyramids that are charged are the oldest ones, and it's their positioning and the kind of stone that they're made of and the alignments. And so it must have been part of a worldwide grid system that actually was creating energy that was sustaining humanity in a way and empowering them. And so even though, you know, they use the pyramids as quarries, and they've bombed them and done all kinds of things, they can't destroy them. And so I think that they were deliberately placed there so that they would survive world floods, and they continue to generate energy, even though they're mostly broken.
Maybe.
And even though energy doesn't flow like it did in the Golden Age. So I think that's the reason.
Is this an earthquake-prone area? And when's the last time they had one? Because I don't think they have in a long time.
They've had earthquakes. If you look at the statues of Memnon down in Luxor, they broke apart. And a whole temple to Ramses, which is the 22nd dynasty, fell down. And so I wouldn't say it's prone.
There's been talk that these pyramids are stabilizers to keep the planet.
They could be stabilizing, but they're built in such a way. I mean, think about it. I mean, if you built something like that and it was cemented together, I mean, and you shook it like an earthquake, it's the least likely thing to fall down.
True. True. How do you think they built the pyramids?
Anti-gravity. I think they had large lifters and small nudgers. and that they were able to move things quite quickly. And also, I think that some of the stone was poured, even though there's substance in the stone that has some shells in it, which would indicate that something was coming from the bottom of a former ocean, mm-hmm. which also speaks to the idea of extreme antiquity, because the ocean's not there anymore, even though there's evidence
right.
that it could have been as close as Abu Roush, which is a few miles away from the Giza Plateau.
Well, and we know the Sphinx had a lot of water on it. You
water
can tell
weathering,
by the erosion.
Yep. Climatology, yep, absolutely. So I think that there's, I think they were built by geniuses, not with cranes, not with anything mechanical. So back to the idea, we think of technology as mechanical or digital. But I think we're not used to it being made of stone. But the thing is they were. I think they were leaving us something to trigger us now. And we've been looking at these images forever and going, I don't know. They must have been nuts. We don't know. We couldn't figure it out. But
old
now,
Ed Lead Skolnin from Coral Castle, he knew.
He knew, and he was a little guy, and he did it himself.
120 pounds all by himself.
Okay, now here's something for you. There's a video on YouTube that shows these discs and the shape of the discs. And what he did is he put a little round magnet in between each of them. So they found these instruments after he passed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically made out of stone. And so prior to that, when I had gone to Abu Ghraib and I looked at these stone circles that are probably 3 feet high and 3 feet square, I never noticed. And this time I went by, and you know what? They've got these little impressions that you could have put magnets in there.
Have you ruled out totally extraterrestrial help or presence here?
No, I haven't. I think as time goes by, I'm softening on that. I mean, it was basically a decision not to come forward that way. And again, we have no proof. I think that, though, the extraterrestrial presence could easily have happened through consciousness, not necessarily through
physical
them walking around and using tractor beams or whatever. So I think that it's still a mystery, and we're making progress on it.
Though, see, I'm down to two theories, one of two theories. Either
okay.
we had very ancient high technology and knowledge from other people on mm-hmm. this planet, humans, but very ancient, that were very advanced. Whether they used telepathy and teleportation, I don't know, but that's very possible. Or there was ET help. But I have mentally ruled out the old 100,000 slaves theory, pulling these blocks up with rope. Not going to happen.
Well, you want to talk about a holographic projection. That's our way of being and thinking projected onto the Egyptians, because there's no evidence of that anywhere. They never found tombs or any mummies in the pyramids. And so much of what we've done is we've projected our own mentality onto them, and we've learned what we're supposed to believe. School teaches us what the teacher wants us to answer, not what's true.
That's the rigidness of Zahi Hawass that I don't like. He won't bend.
He won't bend because he's got an agenda, and that's his story.
That's right.
And you can learn to, you know, if that's the way you're thinking, you can see anything you like. Not see things that are right in front of
him. But he's got this gift to let people open up. Of course, he's going to be gone now.
The thing is, though, is if we don't have a new model, then what's to stop it from just being another person who's like him? Because humanity has become quite rigid in its thinking.
They're going to rock the boat. And let me tell you something. Somebody from Egypt is not going to come forward and say, non-Egyptians built these things. They're not going to say that. They're gonna take the hardline approach that human beings tugged and pulled, and I agree with you, Carmen. It's something else. We'll be back with more, and the next hour we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM with Carmen Bolter. Don't go away. Well, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Carmen Bolter as we talk about Egypt and the pyramids. We'll also get into the ability of humanity and this thought process that created these pyramids when we come right back. Carmen, if you could get into a time machine, would you go back to that era?
Yes.
You would?
Definitely.
I wonder what you'd see.
Pardon me?
I wonder what you'd see.
I think I'd see a lot of high-level initiates doing very important work and manipulating energy in ways that was useful to an overall humanity. And I think that there was a lot of dedication to the whole instead of individuating into little bits competing for resources. And I think that we've lost a lot by deviating from the principles that drove that culture.
Yeah, I think so too. And that area was lush with vegetation and everything else. Probably a gorgeous place to live then.
Gorgeous, comfortable, happy, easy, not driven to work and pay.
In one of your episodes of The Pyramid Code, it's called The Empowered Human. What does that mean?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that I think we've been disempowered. And we think that our voice doesn't count, and they call it a democracy, but it's not. It's really not about interest in what's good for all of humanity. And so the Egyptians didn't demonstrate that. I think that in the distant past, it was about what worked for the whole. It was about leaving more for the children, not using everything up and thinking, well, tough, I'm going to be dead, so I don't care. These principles of living in harmony with nature, and enjoying life rather than, you know, being driven to compete has disempowered us. And I think that even the way we're educated and what happens to people at work, they're told what to do, they're put down, it's hierarchical, it's power over instead of empowerment. And that's at the root of what's really wrong with everything going on the planet right now, I think.
Carmen, when you go back to Egypt, do you still learn new things?
Always. It's interesting because I pore over my pictures and I go to the same places, and it's like as I understand more, I see more. And I absolutely do.
There's no doubt about it. And by the way, the credits on your DVD, incredible. You had a lot of people working on this.
Yes, indeed.
Well, good for you. Now, is there going to be a part two to this?
Well, I've actually been approached about doing. It hasn't been on TV in Canada, and so it could be that a Canadian network picks it up and is looking for a second season, and that's entirely possible.
Was Zahi overwhelmed when you told him you were going to work on this project?
No, because I told him it was an educational project for my students, and I played it down.
You did play it down.
I played it down. Right. I don't think he really knows what it's about.
Do you think he's seen it, though?
I doubt it. I think he'd turn it off.
Really? Because, I mean, it aired in Egypt. You don't think he peeked at it?
I don't know. I have no way of knowing, but I think he would just argue with it and say, I'm right, I know everything, and
so
I don't care.
He never sent you a letter saying, hey, this was great, nice job? Nothing, huh?
No.
Interesting. Now, one of your other works called Angels and Archetypes.
It's an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness, and I wrote that in 1996, which is a good long time ago. And it's actually coming into its own now. People are more interested in this sort of material. So it's looking at how astrology, numerology, and tarot became the symbolism for this archetypal energy. And that's what was dismantled when the esoteric arts were demonized. And so it is kind of the principles of matriarchal cultures and feminine consciousness, which is what has, it's just simply we've lopped it off. The Bible said, you know, women are, you know, prostitutes, or they're bad, we don't need them, and we're going to, you know, procreate without them and that sort of thing. And so there's actually the lore that I think is the way back to a saner world. So it doesn't mean that, you know, women are going to run men and it's just going to, you know, put the shoe on the other foot. It's a whole restructuring of something that's more human, more nature-based, and understanding the characteristic features of different archetypal energies. Now, the simplest definition of an archetype is that it exists whether you're conscious of it or not. And I think that we have these. It's a psychological construct. And the more we can become conscious of these energies, the more aware and wise we become.
No, there's no doubt. There's no doubt at all. Are you particularly spiritual, Carmen?
Oh, yes. I'd say so.
Getting better? More?
Yes. The connections are strong. I mean, I think there's more interference patterns than there used to be. And I think there's a big difference between being religious and being spiritual.
Oh, huge, yeah.
Spiritual means being connected. And I think that people who aren't connected really suffer. I mean, they don't feel a meaning in their life. And that sort of thing. So I definitely say I'm spiritual.
When you are looking at these pyramids, is there a special feeling of awe that that hits you?
Yes. I mean, it puts a real smile on my face because, I can feel the energy inside and out. And I feel really comfortable there in some strange way, more comfortable than I do almost anywhere.
I'm curious what most people, tourists specifically, say or feel when they're out there looking at the pyramids. And how close can you get to them, generally, most people?
Oh, you can walk right up to them and touch them. But as time goes on, there's more and more restriction. And so they put the big wall up. You know, the times that you can be on the plateau are shorter. They're putting little ropes up, and they've got these watchmen saying, no, don't touch.
Does it kind of crumble if you touch it?
No. The Sphinx will. I mean, there's very few places where the Sphinx isn't covered, like I said, with a plastic bag, I call it. But there's a couple of places that are up and inside that it's sand. It's very, very, very fragile.
Why or how could these pyramids have lasted so long?
My answer to that is they were designed to. Now, the younger pyramids, when they used, like the modern Egyptians didn't care about them at all. They would have taken them down if they could have. But there are some smaller pyramids at Abu Sir and sites that are further south. And they took the casing stones off, and now these pyramids, they crumble. And so, as always, with anything in the ancient world, the older is the better constructed.
Right, absolutely. How many pyramids do you think there might be on this planet? Known pyramids? Hundreds?
400.
Yeah, that's a lot. And they're all pretty similar?
Yes, and some are mounds, and, you know, some were tombs, because they actually found the body of Lord Pakal in South America, or Central America. And so, yes, they're similar, and nothing, though, is like the Great Pyramid.
What do you think the pharaohs that came after the construction of the Great Pyramid, for example, what do you think they thought about them? I mean, do you think they were at a loss, too, for this civilization? Was there a gap there, too?
Absolutely, I do. And the thing is as the dynasties progressed, and in certain dynasties, it was ego-driven. It was about power over me, mine. And so they took them over and said, you know, I'm taking over. You know, whatever's going on, it's mine. And then they did some reconstruction, which is probably the last restoration was in 2450 BC.
They put their own little identity on it, didn't they?
That's right. That's right. And so I don't think we're getting the true story at all.
No, not at all. The stories of curses of King Tut and things like that, believable?
No, I think there was something in mummy tissue that people inhaled and all of that.
Yeah.
No,
I don't think it was bacteria, some kind of mold or fungus.
No, but there's definitely some funny business that went on when he died and how he died and how his tomb ended up the way it was. And I don't think the truth has come out about that entire period of time in Egypt.
What about this other work? Aren't you working on another new book on the 18th dynasty?
Yes, indeed. Like basically, I have a real affinity for the Amarna period, and I think that Akhetaten, which is what it was called in the ancient days, was one of the most peaceful, functional, creative, loving, enjoyable, beautiful places there could have been in the world. And they say he was crazy, and, you know, if not in Nefertiti, they just go on and on and on about what was wrong with them. And I think that's because they shut down the Amun priesthood, who were making a lot of money off the populace by telling them that they needed to pay for their salvation. And they just shut it down, which would kind of be like pulling the plug on Wall Street and, you know, the government's paying each other and just shutting them down.
So he had the guts to do this?
He had the guts to do that, and the Amun priesthood really plotted to take him down after. And, you know, lots of past life memories about that as well. And, so that was a beautiful time for sure, for sure.
Do you believe that the pyramids of Giza were constructed to echo the Belt and Orion?
Yes. But it goes north and south of that. And so I've been doing a lot of work in Starry Night Pro to look at the patterns of how these star patterns move through time, because I'm trying to decipher, you know, were they built in, you know, 50,000 BC? And what Starry Night Pro allows you to do is go back 999,000 BC and 999,000 AD. And so I plotted a certain number of stars in the extragalactic meridian, and it circulates around Sirius, which makes sense of Walter Cruttendon's theory that we're actually in a binary system, our sun and Sirius. And then it moves along to the Belt of Orion, and you see Isis with her arm around Osiris and the belt, and he's pointing toward the Pleiades. So when you look at the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, you see he's on a solar boat, which is like a wormhole, and this whole configuration is moving in a direction. Well, then where does that go? And if you keep plotting it along that meridian, you get to Cygnus, and then it goes straight into the galactic center. So taking that configuration and moving it back 100,000 years and forward 100,000 years, it doesn't come apart. You take any other constellation, put it into the solar system or the different places, and everything falls apart. So when you move through cycles of time, they don't stay together. Now, how the Egyptians figured that out, I'm still scratching my head. But that's what we've got. It looks like the pyramids are scattered, but they're a marker. Isn't that interesting?
Well, how they figured out just about anything is still baffling, isn't it?
It's baffling, but they have found lenses and stuff. They could have had telescopes. They found these little computer kinds of things that, you know, were disks within disks. You know, and there's artifacts all over the world that actually came from Egypt, and things were hidden. I mean, when the big scramble was happening and the dark forces were taking over, it was natural to hide things. And a lot of the information that's making sense to me now was hidden at Nag Hammadi. The way the Dead Sea Scrolls were hidden when the Council of Nicene said, okay, we're wiping this out of the Bible, and if you're caught with it or saying anything about it, we're killing you. Well, the same thing with Nag Hammadi, and these texts were hidden close to the Temple of Dendera, which is near and dear to my heart. And they, of course, were badly interpreted. It took them 21 years. They were done by Christians, and they weren't mystics. They didn't understand what they were talking about. And so, you know, the knowledge is there, and things have really been hidden, that's for sure.
Do you think there could be even more Dead Sea Scrolls hidden away somewhere?
Why not? Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, and they're similar, but they're telling the story of the feminine and in a divine feminine voice and honoring the earth and everything we've departed from. And so what has been exchanged is a cultural myth. So instead of a loving mother goddess that interacts with us and has faith in us, they turned it into an old man who's doing surveillance on you, who's going to hit you with a lightning bolt if you don't behave and do what he wants.
Speculate. What remains to be found out there in Egypt? What do you think? More tombs? More what?
Well, they certainly found huge statues of goddesses in villages, and they don't tend to announce the stuff where it's been the honoring of the god.
And how do they find them? By excavation?
Well, largely because it's so populous there that people are trying to build houses, and they go dunk dunk, and they find something, and then they go and investigate.
I see.
So, yeah, there's a lot left to be found.
But, I mean, the sands of the desert there truly make things almost buried. Wasn't the Sphinx almost buried up to its nose or something?
Well, to its neck, and then they excavated, and then it was back up to its neck. And, you know, there's certain places like even at the Temple of the Queen of Sheba at Marib in Yemen, where they excavate it, and they only have a certain amount of time. They take a few pictures, they leave because their excavation season's over. They come back, it's all buried again.
It fills up that fast?
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course. And I mean, the Sphinx manages to stay clear right now because they've got, you know, people there. But certainly in Yemen, it does.
If you left the Sphinx alone, for how many years would the sand cover it up?
Oh, it would take a while.
I mean, what, 5,000 years?
No, I don't know. I'm thinking 100 years.
That's it? You may be right. So,
well, the sand blows. But the thing is that in the old times, it wasn't sand. It was lush green.
That's right.
The river was right there.
You had topsoil. You had everything then.
Oh, yeah. It must have been fantastic.
Things didn't blow away.
But one of the things that we did in the Pyramid Code was make animations, putting the river back and putting the trees back. And I'm telling you, the first time I saw that animation, my heart just sang, and my whole being was just like, oh, because I remember it that way.
Did they ever have to dig away from the Sphinx? I mean, from the pyramids at all? In terms of the sand?
Well, over time, probably, but no.
I guess my question is it possible that there are there are cities that are buried 500 or 1,000 feet with sand on top of them?
Well, here's a case in point. At Esna, where you clear the locks when you're going up and down the Nile on a cruise ship, there is a temple there that is actually way, way down deep because the entire village was built over the top of it. And somebody found thunk, thunk, and they found it. It took them 50 years to excavate and get the sand out of there. But the beauty of it is that it wasn't damaged by the Christians who came along with their chisels and you know, really did a lot of damage to the temples. And so what you see is these beautiful colors and undamaged frescoes because they only found it recently.
How deep down was it?
Oh, 50, 60 feet.
Totally covered.
Totally. Right to, over the top. And there are temples like at Dendera where it's a Ptolemaic, which is recent in Alexander the Great's day, over the top. And if you look at the floor, you can see the tops of temple pillars underneath.
See, I'm convinced there must be civilizations and artifacts and buildings that could be thousands of feet underground.
Well, and older is deeper, which is why archaeology only started when psychology started in 1910, around there. And so they're finding all the surface stuff. And as we dig deeper, we find things that are older. Older is deeper. It's a simple axiom of archaeology.
This planet probably over the years, and I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of years, has gotten bigger with this, with what's, whatever's happening, don't you think? The dust and everything else.
Sure. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff that's hidden very deep, but it's also hidden deep within our psyches because the powers that be don't want us to find it. And then, and I've been with archaeologists and at scientist conferences where they're actually instructed, and the scientists are coming out and telling the stories, they're instructed to bury the thing because it doesn't fit with the common knowledge.
You are at odds with what you probably believe is some kind of a new world order or something like that to control knowledge.
Oh yeah.
Have you always thought that way?
Yes, right from the beginning. Yeah. A lot of things that are becoming more common knowledge now that I thought right from I seem to catch things like that quite quickly where, you know, it's there's something wrong with it and it doesn't make sense to me. But yeah, there's a lot of power over and control and systems that do not serve people.
Why do they do this? Why do they want to suppress the knowledge? Is it greed? Are they afraid of losing control? What is it?
Yep, greed, period, and being afraid of losing control. But the thing is that if you're in that game, you have to have all the money in the whole wide world. I mean, there's never enough. You want more and more power, more control, more power, more control.
Where can people see the Pyramid Code?
Well, there's a page on pyramidcode.com order, and you can see it on Netflix and on Hulu, and you can order it all over the world now in the PAL version, in Europe and the Middle East, and in NTSC, which is the North American version, and Asia. And so there's a list there of everywhere you can get it.
On a 1 to 10, how happy are you with it?
Pretty happy. It's done really well. 9.
Now, you've had a lot of great response to this.
Oh, and George, after being on your show, thousands of emails. Because what it's doing is it's triggering people who remember, and they're like, oh, I always knew it. You know, they're so relieved. And the most common comment I get about it is that people watch it over and over and over again when they finish it.
Absolutely. And do you find doing a book is so much different than doing a DVD or a video?
Well, and I have quite a bit of resistance. Even though I'm an academic and I love research, I certainly don't want to do a book on the Pyramid Code unless it's a video book, like a VOOC, they call them now.
Yeah.
So that the animations are there and the film is there, because that's what is instructing people, just, you know, with their own sense of looking at it. They can come to their own conclusions as well. And so, I mean, there's a place for both of them. But I think that now we've got so much beautiful technology and screens and, you know, I really enjoy the rich color shining through.
Would you call yourself an Egyptologist by now?
Well, you're not allowed to, because you have to learn the stories that they want to teach and, you know, and repeat. They
really?
Basically recite the stories. And the only way you can be trained as an Egyptologist is in Egypt, at an Egyptian university, speaking Arabic, and they have too many English guides. I actually looked into it.
I did not know that. And Carmen, we were going to hit this break. We'll come back, talk about some more things, and also take some phone calls with you. Final hour to go with Carmen Boulder right here on Coast to Coast AM.